All right, well, let's get started this morning. I'm going to read from Psalm 44, just to set the tone. O God, we have heard with our ears, our fathers have told us, what deeds you performed in their days, in the days of old. You, with your own hand, drove out the nations, but them you planted. You afflicted the peoples, but them you set free. For not by their own sword did they win the land, nor did their own arm save them. But your right hand and your arm and the light of your face, for you delighted in them. Psalm 44 lays out for us something of a pattern for church history. The stories I want to tell are not ultimately about men or women, but about the God who delighted in them. This morning, I want you to delight in history. I want you to take joy in the stories I tell. I take joy in them, and hopefully you'll catch some of that passion, and it'll be infectious. But I delight in these stories and these people, and I want you to delight in these stories and these people, because God delighted in them, because they are His treasured possession. And as these stories will tell you, He will move heaven and earth for His church. That's the beauty of these stories. Brad asked me to come and speak, and he said, I want you to talk on why you are an RP. And as he's already alluded to, in terms of the personal story, in terms of the personal history, I am an RP because when I was in high school, there was a redhead, and she was RP. And so I started worshiping with her family on Sunday nights. And that was my exposure to the RP. And by the way, as a hint for all of the ladies, she came to me with a stack of books and her pastor's phone number and said, if we have a relationship, fix your theology. Those weren't her exact words, but that was the gist. So she was unashamedly RP. But for me to be an RP, to be a covenanter, there's something I need to know about what a covenanter is. And I know that the headline is why I am an RP. You're not going to hear me use the phrase RP all that often. I'm switching over to covenanter. Hopefully you'll see why. So why am I a covenanter? Why am I going to tell the stories of a covenanter? Let me lay the scene for you for a moment. Perhaps there is no more essential question in all of church history, or life for that matter, than the question of identity. Who am I might be the most relevant and eternal question ever asked by humanity. To attempt an answer, however, each subject must address the quandary of lineage. Our fathers play a most vital role in discovering self-identity. To know who I am, I need to know who my fathers were. From Adam to Alan. And yes, my father is Alan. From Adam to Alan, I need to know who they are. And within the RPCNA, the Scottish Covenanters especially, have possessed an almost hallowed status. After all, their blood is the seed of our church. In recent years, however, the memory of these faithful martyrs has grown rather dim. Story passed into legend, and in our own day, tales have nearly been lost among living memory. It may be time to sound the alarm, for anybody without identity cannot endure, and no identity without understanding its forefathers can remain intact. Our memory of our fathers must be a living memory. The significant question before us this morning, then, is who were the covenanters? What did they believe? And how did they live? We must also ask, do they in their folk ways, what they believe and how they live? That's the phrase I'll use time and again. Their folk ways, what they believed and how they lived. Do they really matter? Is their value, has their value to our age so diminished that they are best relegated to the cold, two-dimensional pages of textbooks? Or do their tales contain truth? Do their memories reveal strength that, if recovered, might bear fruit again? These questions are the ones we must answer. Will we recall our fathers? Will we make their stories live as we live? I am my father's, plural, son. from Adam to Alan, I will remember them and I will honor them. Exodus 20:12. Not by setting them up as idols, nor by shuffling them into the closet, but by seeking to vanquish their legacy of sin and by promoting their heritage of righteousness, I will take my place in their history and I will remember the God of my fathers. And that's the challenge I want you to take up. You are not an island. You do not live in this world for this moment and then move on. You are your father's children. You have inherited their sin and their righteousness. You belong to this story, but why? The Scottish Covenanters, it begins, as he mentioned, in 1517, where this little German monk, at night, in the dark, pounded a nail into the door with 95 theses or propositions, truths, that he posted there in Latin. This amounted to an academic invitation. Come and let us debate indulgences and papal authority. But Professor Luther had a problem that all professors have. He had students. And his students took this Latin theses, which were an invitation to come and discuss the matter, and they put it into German. And what started out as Martin Luther's attempt to say, come, let us dialogue, let the scholars and the pastors discuss this matter, overnight became a wildfire throughout Eastern Europe. Martin Luther lit Europe on fire, and he had no intention of doing it. In the West, in Western Europe, there was another guy, John Calvin, where this fiery redhead got a hold of him, William Farrell, and told him, you must stay in Geneva. Calvin wanted to study, be a quiet, lonely, ivory tower theologian. Be left alone, read his books, write books. Farrell would have nothing of it. And Calvin, too, he lit Western Europe on fire. And as Europe burns under the heat of the Reformation, as Luther and Calvin turn the whole world upside down, sparks begin to fly. And some of them land among the moss and the heather of Scotland. That's how our story begins. There's this young man named Patrick Hamilton. He's the son of a wealthy family. And if you are wealthy in the 1500s, you send your children to Europe. You see, Scotland's a backwater world. Scotland is a place for sheep, a place for goats, a place for wild-haired people with kilts. It's not a place for scholars or wealthy, well-to-do sons to be well-educated. And so they send Patrick Hamilton to Europe. But what his parents probably didn't realize is that Luther, 11 years earlier, had lit Europe on fire. While he's studying in Europe, Patrick Hamilton reads the works of Luther. Patrick Hamilton comes back to Scotland in 1527. Mark the date, 1527. And there in Scotland, he begins to preach Luther's gospel. By faith alone, rather by grace alone, through faith alone. Patrick Hamilton preaches. His family is converted. A few of his immediate friends are converted. They begin to believe the gospel when the bishop in St. Andrews hears this gospel. He knows Lutheranism when he hears it. So in February 1528, did you catch those dates? In February 1528, the only reason the dates are significant is not because you have a test. This guy did not have long. He came home in 1527. He preached for a few months, and he preached grace alone, faith alone, and the bishop said, you are a Lutheran. And they burned him at the stake outside of St. Andrews in February 1528. Patrick Hamilton marks the first seed. His blood was shed in St. Andrews, but his gospel could not be silenced. He brings the fire of Lutheranism to Scotland. This is how the Scottish Covenanters begin, with sparks from Europe. But there is also one who takes an even bigger trend. So not only does Patrick Hamilton inherit the Lutheran view of the gospel and bring it into Scotland, but the one who really shakes the nation free is John Knox. John Knox had an interesting beginning. John Knox was an enormous man. He was physically imposing, very broad-shouldered, very tall, massive arms. You know the sword in Braveheart, the two-handed claymore? John Knox carried one of those and used it. He was hired by a man called George Wishart. George Wishart had been converted and was preaching throughout the land of Scotland. But George Wishart had a death sentence on his head, and he knew what happened to Patrick Hamilton. So George Wishart hired a bodyguard, a great big redhead named John Knox. John Knox carried around this sword and served as a bodyguard for Wishart. Wishart laid the next foundation, if you will. With Patrick Hamilton, you see how Lutheranism, the gospel recovered by Luther, came to Scotland. And Wishart begins to preach it. But Wishart also lived it. He had a chance that Hamilton never had. When the city of Dundee was struck by a plague, all the priests fled for their lives, as any sane human would do. George Wishart, thank God, was not sane. No, he was a Christian. And so he went into the city of Dundee and he bathed the bodies of the dead and dying. And he preached to men like they were dead and dying. And the city of Dundee became called the Mini Geneva, because it was the house where the gospel lived. It was the city where the preaching of George Wishart found a home. George Wishart, outside the city of Edinburgh, was captured. John Knox wanted to go with him. And George turned to him and said, "No, one lamb at a time. One sacrifice at a time. It is enough." John Knox flees for his life. He continues to preach throughout the land. He eventually ends up in Big Geneva, in Geneva, Switzerland. There he works with John Calvin. He is the pastor of the English-speaking congregation in Geneva. And there Knox breathes deep Calvinism. He drinks deep from the well of Calvin, and he brings Calvinism back to Scotland, and Scotland is never the same. To this day, although in name only, the Church of Scotland is Presbyterian, because John Knox brought Calvinistic Presbyterianism to Scotland. To this day, there is an educational system in Scotland that requires religious classes, because John Knox taught Scotland that the Bible was the foundation of the educational system. Scotland doesn't believe that today, but they still have religious classes in their public education because of John Knox's Calvinism. This stuff is alive and well today. Here is then my first point. The Scottish Covenanters begin with the Reformation in Europe. The fire that is burning in Europe casts off sparks and they alight in Scotland. Those sparks are Patrick Hamilton, George Wishart, and John Knox. They are the sparks that God used to light the Reformation in Scotland. These men were consumed with a zeal for the gospel. I've already mentioned these stories. Patrick Hamilton dies just months after preaching. I've been in ministry nearly 3 years. I can't imagine 5 or 6 months and then saying, your time's up. You've preached and you're done. Go home. He had barely any time to begin anything. But he gave his life for the gospel. George Wishart gave his life for the gospel. John Knox was imprisoned 2 years as a galley slave for the gospel. He was exiled to Europe for nearly 10 years for the gospel. These are men who were consumed with a zeal for the gospel, and they would pay any price for it. Later, after John Knox, Andrew Melville leads the Presbyterian charge. Consumed with a zeal for the gospel, he confronts James VI, later James I, face to face, head on. He's thrown into prison in London and later exiled to Europe. These men paid an awful price to preach the gospel. Alexander Henderson, Samuel Rutherford were men consumed for the gospel. They preached in small, struggling congregations that really never saw fruit, that really never saw growth. They saw exile, they saw banishment, and Samuel Rutherford died in his bed with soldiers knocking on his door to bring him to his execution. These were men for whom the gospel had a cost. And it wasn't symbolized with giving up TV. It wasn't symbolized with giving up chocolate. It was a real cost. And they had a zeal for the gospel. Donald Cargill was executed in Edinburgh. Alexander Payton lived half of his life on the run, sleeping in caves. He died cold and alone. Richard Cameron was murdered at Eardsmoss. James Rennick was martyred in Edinburgh. The story of the Scottish covenanting pastors is that you don't lay in a soft, comfortable bed. You die in the wilderness because you love Christ. This is their story. These are their folkways. They inherit this zeal from Europe. These pastors then are so consumed by it that there's no price too high. They will pay the price. But these men, consumed by the gospel, I mean, it's easy for me to stand up here and say, look at these men, look at these pastors. Are you not in awe of these pastors who would pay this incredible price for the gospel? Oh boy. You know what's next? They passed their zeal from one to the next. It wasn't kept for themselves. There's these two great stories I want to tell you. First is about Alexander Henderson. Alexander Henderson wrote the National Covenant. Not alone, but he was a significant contributor. Alexander Henderson was the head of the Scottish delegates who went to Westminster to write the Westminster Confession. He was in charge of the Scottish delegates. This guy is no slouch. This guy is an expert. He was ordained and to be installed at a church in Lucas. In Scotland. Lucas was a church to whom the Reformation had come. The church loved the gospel, they loved Jesus Christ, and they learned that Alexander Henderson did not. He was not a believer. He did not come to preach the gospel. So at his ordination service, the church in Lucas locked and chained the doors to the church. With him outside. They are holding his installation service and they won't let him come to it because he doesn't believe the gospel. Well, Henderson has a great idea. I can't break down the door, so I'll break the window. The man smashes a window in the church, climbs in, and gets installed as the pastor in Lucas. How would you like that for the start of your pastoral ministry? A few days later, a few weeks later, Robert Bruce is preaching in the area, a powerful Scottish covenanting preacher. Alexander Henderson goes, I've heard so much about this Robert Bruce, I want to go hear him. So Henderson goes out into the wilds, into the fields where Bruce is preaching. And Bruce, of course, in the providence of God, is preaching on John chapter 10. Anyone who comes through the gate, he is mine. He knows me and I know him. But if someone comes into the sheepfold by another way, if he climbs over the fence, parenthetically, if he breaks a window and climbs in, he is not mine and you are not to listen to him. Alexander Henderson is ripped to shreds. His heart is shattered. He is broken by the preaching of the word. The zeal of the gospel that consumed Robert Bruce to preach the word of God with authority and clarity pierced the soul of Alexander Henderson. And he became the Scottish covenanter we know him to be. The one who writes the National Covenant, the one who writes Westminster, or at least helps in the process. But it starts with Robert Bruce preaching a sermon and God using it. There's another story. It begins with Samuel Rutherford. Samuel Rutherford was one of the delegates who went to Westminster, who helped write Westminster. Samuel Rutherford was a pastor of a very small rural church in Anwath, southwest corner of Scotland. Samuel Rutherford was exiled. He was taken from his beloved church and locked away in St. Andrews. Samuel Rutherford, for a time, was a professor of theology at the Glasgow University. And there he had a student. And Samuel Rutherford, I could only imagine, have you read the letters of Rutherford? This man's heart was on fire. It was unbelievable. He writes the letters of Rutherford, obviously, he writes his own letters, hence the letters of Rutherford. And as he writes his letters, there's this passion for Christ that's almost embarrassing. I mean, his love is almost romantic. It's this zeal that is disgusting. And it's infectious. And Donald Cargill sits in his classes, the University of Glasgow. And Donald Cargill drinks from the well of Samuel Rutherford. And the passion and the love for Jesus Christ that Rutherford has, Cargill drinks it in. And Donald Cargill becomes a Scottish covenanting pastor. And he preaches in the wild. He lives on the run. And at last he is captured outside of Edinburgh. He's arrested. He's tried. And I have stood where he was hung. He died for his faith, consumed with a zeal for the gospel. When Donald Cargill was hung on the Royal Mile, there's this section very vivid in my mind. There's this little street corner, this little close, they call it, a little side street. There on the corner, Cargill died. On the Royal Mile, the crowd had gathered for this entertaining show. They didn't have TV or Netflix or anything in those days, so they came to watch hangings for entertainment. And so, as Cargill is there, I still don't know whatever possessed them to do this. But for some reason, these covenanting pastors, when they were being killed in Edinburgh, the soldiers, the hangmen, would always let them have one final sermon. You know how you have last words, last paragraph? They let these guys have last sermons. Cargill gets up there and he opens Revelation, reads off his passage, and preaches for half an hour. Like, all of them did this. It's incredible. Why would you let a dying man preach you a sermon? He's going to convert the crowd. And sure enough, standing in the crowd is 18-year-old, freshman, University of Edinburgh, James Renick. James Renick. James Renick is so moved by the preaching of Cargill, so in awe of his sacrifice for the gospel as he swings from the scaffold, that James Renick joins the covenanting cause, and James Renick becomes the final Scottish covenanting pastor. He is the last to die. Here is the picture I hope you're getting. Calvin and Luther lit Europe aflame with a passion for Jesus and his gospel. That passion then spread to Scotland through Patrick Hamilton, through John Knox. Then these pastors become consumed with the gospel. Their leaders had this passion for the gospel. It then spread from one leader to the next, from Robert Bruce to Alexander Henderson, from Samuel Rutherford to Don Cargill to James Renick. They passed this passion along. And again, it would be easy to step back and go, well, okay, so we know what the standard is for Brad and I. We know what we're supposed to be like. Ready to die at a moment's notice. Ready to preach. Ready to pray. Ready to always, before your eyes, look like we're consumed with passion for the gospel. We're lying to you if we look that way. And so are these men. They're real men. With real sins. With real faults. And we'll look at those in a bit. But this zeal for the gospel was not just among the leaders. The Scottish covenanters, their folkways are, they inherit the gospel from Europe. Their pastors become consumed with a passion for the gospel. And they pass that passion on from one man to the next. Young men, this is your job. Inherit gospel passion from your elders and your pastor. Drink from the well. Find men consumed with the gospel and get close to them. And learn their gospel passion. Same for you, young ladies. find women who are full of passion for the gospel. Get close to them and drink from their passion. This is how it moved then to the common people. This is the, for me, this is the extraordinary story of the Scottish Covenanters. It's easy to tell a story from church history and say, oh, look at these incredible missionaries. Look at these incredible pastors. But in the Scottish Covenanters, the story isn't all about leaders, but the common people themselves. The common people became consumed by a zeal for the gospel. Again, let me illustrate it. They went to things called conventicles. Conventicles. I'd spell it for you, but your computers would tell me I'm wrong because that word isn't actually in their spell checker. The conventicles. These are meetings for worship out in the wild in the wilderness. No heated air-conditioned rooms, no padded pews, none of it. You sit on a rock or grass, you stand up or lean against a tree, you feel the cold, you feel the rain, and you don't care. They were consumed with a passion for the gospel. There is a place called Drumclog. I've stood on the hill. I've seen the plain. There on the hill of Drumclog, they met for worship. There's nothing. And when I mean nothing, I mean like Western Kansas, there isn't a cow in sight. It's nothing. They're out there in the wild. It's swampland down one hill and empty plain as far as the eye can see down the other hill. And here on the hilltop, they have come from miles before cars, electric or gas. They walked. At best, they had a horse or a donkey. Most of them walked for miles because they wanted the preaching of the word. Because they wanted the sacraments. They were hungering and thirsting. How far would you go for biblical worship? How far would you go? And I don't mean in a car for 3 hours. I mean on foot for a day. This is what they did. The common people were consumed with a zeal for the gospel. But there's something else about Drumclog. Another part of this story. As they're sitting on the hilltop, having journeyed far, far, far for this worship service to hear the preaching of the word, the dragoons, these are the king's soldiers. They arrive under a man from Claverhouse. And he rides to the base of the hill. And these covenanters tell their women and children to flee into the woods while they turn from worshiping God to shooting their enemies. My point is not to justify their actions. My point is to illustrate the cost. This is the price they had to pay. I cannot imagine sending my children running through swamps and woods not knowing if they made it home. I can't imagine having the pastor give the benediction and then say, load your gun. I don't live in that world. They did. They didn't have to just journey far. Oh, it's a long walk to the conventicle. Yeah, and you might die while you're there. They were consumed with a zeal for the gospel. This was the high price they would pay. Then at Skeoch Hill, another time a conventicle gathered. Skeoch Hill is this hill that's sort of hollowed out at the top. So it looks sort of like a crown where the center is this bowl. Covenanters gathered there, some 3,000. A pastor was in town, not a common thing in these days. And he was preaching. And as he preached, they prepared for the Lord's Supper. These 3,000 covenanters dipped into the bowl to take the Lord's Supper, and the most remarkable thing happened. The dragoons arrived again. Again, they have journeyed far for this service of worship. Again, they might die. The king's soldiers are here. And a most remarkable picture. The dragoons ring the top of the hill and watch. They didn't bring enough bullets. They didn't bring enough soldiers. There are 3,000 covenanters in there, and the dragoons can't touch him. It is this awesome picture of the church in every age. When you get together in that sanctuary or any sanctuary, your enemies ring you and you worship in their teeth and they can't touch you. Daniel worships in the mouth of the lion and they can't touch him. The covenanters worship in the teeth of the dragoons and they can't touch them. This was the cost of worshiping Jesus in this day. A long hike and no promise you'll come home. And they paid the price. They paid it because they were in love with Jesus Christ. They were consumed with love for Jesus Christ. The common people had this passion. They too had the passion of martyrdom. This is striking. It's not just the pastors who paid the price, who died. You know the story of the two Margarets? I've stood there. I've stood in the reeds. I've watched the wind blow along the Firth, where the water had once lapped up over their bodies. They tied the older Margaret farther out so that she would drown first, so that the younger Margaret would have a chance to see exactly what her future was and be given a chance to repent and change. When they persisted, as the water lapped up the body of the younger Margaret, having watched her friend die, they asked her, "Will you recant? Will you renounce Jesus Christ? Will you give up these covenanter ways?" And this Margaret answered by singing Psalm 25, selection A, probably B and C as well. She sang 25 until the water filled her mouth and she was no more. She was an 18-year-old girl, 18. But dying for Christ was easy. Dying for Christ was a choice she had already made years before. This is the picture. John Brown there's several John Browns. John Brown of Priest Hill. And this John Brown, again, Bloody Graham of Claver House, arrived at his house. I've not been to his house. I've been by his house. It's way out there. Claver House has to really be aggressive to go out and find this guy. John Brown had been providing safe haven for Alexander Payton, one of the covenanting pastors. He would house him. He would feed him. He would take care of him. He would tend his wounds. Claver House found out about this, was livid, went out to visit John Brown and shot him dead. Right in front of his wife. Said to his wife, "What do you think of your husband now, lady?" She answered him, "I thought much of him when he was alive, but I think even more of him now that he's with Jesus." She loved Jesus. She loved Jesus more than she loved her husband. Her husband being with Jesus made him a better man. George Wood was 16 years old. He was working in the fields. It was hot. He took a lunch break. He sat in the shade of the trees. I stood there too. I stood there in the glade where he sat on a stump and he pulled out his Bible. Soldiers rode by as he ate his lunch and read his Bible. They saw the Bible and they said, "You must be a covenanter." And they shot him. That night, his fiance found him. These are common people. These are 16 and 18 year old kids. And they're paying this price for the gospel. Why? Why do pastors pay this price for the gospel? Why do these common teenage kids pay the price for the gospel? Why do they do this? What is the driving impulse? Yes, I keep saying passion for the gospel, love for Jesus Christ. Yes, yes, yes. But I want to bring it home. They made this decision before the gun was pointed at them. You know how we ask the question? If somebody stuck a gun in your face and said, "Do you believe Jesus? Will you die for it?" What would you say? "Oh, I don't know. I don't know." Guys, the question is made today. The answer is given today. We may never have to face the barrel of a gun and say, "Yes, I am that committed to Christ." What about talking to a stranger about Jesus? Are you that committed to Christ? What about actually giving up the sin you cherish and harbor in your heart? Are you that committed to Christ? We may not be asked to die physically, But boy, are we asked to die every day. The story of these people, the story I want you to get here, is not that these are great heroes of the faith. These are ordinary people. George Wood did not want to die at lunch. He wanted to go home and see his fiancée that night and marry her. That's what he wanted. But he had already made the decision. I'm a dead man already. I live for Jesus, not for me or my fiancée. And so when the gun's in his face, it's easy to answer. Are you willing to die? I've been dying all along. That's the attitude. The great story here isn't that they died for Jesus. It's that they lived for Jesus. This is their first folkway. This is the folkway I want you to get. Who are the Scottish Covenanters? People who live for the gospel. Who live for it so much that it looks an awful lot like death. Daily. It looks like death. These are the leaders. These are their commoners. I'm telling you this story. But there's something else. There's another piece to their folkway. This gospel passion that motivates them to live for Jesus and then to die for Jesus also motivated them to have an expansive view of the gospel. The gospel isn't our little American dream of you're a sinner, you need Jesus. That's a small and accurate picture of the gospel. Theirs was larger. Theirs was a big public and political vision. When they thought of the gospel, they didn't think just of Jesus rules you and Jesus rules you. Their vision was Jesus rules every breath and blade of grass. It was an immense vision for the gospel. So John Knox stands in the court of Mary. This is unbelievable. She is queen. She rules. She has the power of the sword. And John Knox stands there and he shakes his finger in her face. And he says, then rule like someone who loves Jesus. Rule like somebody who knows the gospel. Rule like someone who understands the Bible. He confronts her on specific personal sin. You may not share your bed with that man, queen. You're not married. This is harsh stuff for anybody to hear. He's telling a queen. She is not above the gospel. She is not above Christ. This is John Knox's vision of the gospel. Even the queen must come. Andrew Melville, you may have heard this story, stands in the castle. I've been by the castle. I've seen it. I haven't been in it. It's the winter palace. It's the winter residence, meaning that James is in this palace on vacation. He's resting. Andrew Melville comes into the castle, into the palace, gets an audience with James, and they're dialoguing. And James says to him, look, Melville, you preach and you preach a lot. And man, when you preach, you say some things I don't want to hear. And Melville walks up to him and says, you silly vassal. That means you foolish servant. Do you not know that there are two kings in Scotland? Yes, you rule the political one, but Jesus rules you. In the church, you are but a member, though you are a king in the state. And Andrew Melville stands toe-to-toe with James, and believe me, it cost him. It cost Melville to say that. He's thrown in prison in London, and then exiled to Europe. But this is their vision. Even kings and queens are subject to the gospel of Jesus Christ. Donald Cargill writes the Torwood Declaration. He excommunicates the king. Excommunicates the king. He's asked to give a defense. On what grounds can a pastor throw the king out of the church? And Cargill goes, he's under Jesus, and I serve Jesus. What I bind in heaven, loose in heaven. Not me personally, but the courts of the church. This is their vision for the gospel. Kings and queens bow. Richard Cameron later goes into the village of Sankar. I've stood at the market cross. I've seen the place where he nailed the Sankar Declaration, excommunicating the next king. And I have stood at that same market cross where, some 10 years later, James Renick marched into town with a Sankar Declaration, a second one, excommunicating the next king. These Scottish Covenanters excommunicated kings when they did not confess or obey Christ. They believed the king belonged to Jesus. They believed that the civil magistrate belonged to Jesus. They had a political and public vision for the gospel. So too, as Brad mentioned earlier, the covenants and the confessions that they held to. In 1638, I want you guys to get this picture. This is really important. You hear these words thrown around, the National Covenant. Do you know why it was called the National Covenant? Because everybody in the nation signed it. Do you know how we got the U.S. Constitution? We begged, bartered, and dealed, and compromised until we got 13 colonies to say, okay. New York was the holdout. They had to write the Federalist Papers. Madison did, and a few others, to argue New York joined this union. Oh, and by the way, in 1860, there was a few other states that said this union's no good. Didn't work out so well for them. But this is the nature of our Constitution. To this day, there's this fight and this debate about the power of the Constitution, the significance of the Constitution. In 1638, they draft what amounts to a constitution, a covenant. This is how Scotland will run. They commit themselves to three things. The reformed religion in worship and in practice, the removal of everything papal, and the expansion of the gospel. As they commit to these things in the National Covenant, this is staggering. In Greyfriars Kirkyard, the nobles and the pastors sign. Then they take copies of this National Covenant and they ride all over the countryside. Have you seen Amazing Grace? Where he takes the scroll there and he goes all over the countryside and has people sign some, what was it, 300,000 people signed to end slavery? That's what they did with the National Covenant. They rode all over Scotland and they had elders and they had farmers and they had fishermen. They had shepherds. They had the lowest of society sign the National Covenant. Noblemen, the leaders in the civil government. They had pastors and elders, leaders in the churches. They had just commoners from top to bottom. The nation covenanted. The nation. It was a grassroots movement. This was an expansive view of the gospel. It's not a top-down approach. It's not go to Washington, D.C. and enforce this vision of the world. It was a grassroots thing. The population pressed for it. The people, the nation itself, were consumed with a passion for the gospel. So they gathered at Greyfriars. They gathered all over the nation. And they said, let's sign this covenant and promise to be Christ's. It was a communal, a public, a political expression of faith. One other part to this covenant was the later the Solemn League and Covenant. And I want to contrast these. Because what happens in the Solemn League and Covenant is a shift in gears. The English Civil War has broken out. Cromwell and Parliament is fighting against Charles I and the king, the monarchy. Who will rule? Elected officials of the people or the divinely orchestrated monarchy? England is at war over this. They're killing people over this. And so, Charles and Cromwell go to Scotland and say, we need Scottish soldiers. We need help. And Scotland says, I make no joke, you can have a Scottish army if we can have a reformation. That's the Solemn League and Covenant. In exchange for bringing Reformed and Presbyterian religion into England and Ireland, we will give you a Scottish army. Cromwell signs. Cromwell agrees to the Solemn League and Covenant. The effect of that covenant is the Westminster Confession. The Solemn League and Covenant promises, we will bring the Reformation into Ireland and England. We will preserve the Reformation in Scotland in exchange for a Scottish army defeating Charles. The Scottish army defeats Charles. The Scottish army turns Charles over to Cromwell. Cromwell cuts his head off, and the Covenanters are livid. That was not the intent. They had no interest in slaughtering their monarch. But he was dead, and in the meantime, they had held Westminster. In the meantime, they had fashioned this confession. Brad mentioned earlier, this confession is not simply, here's the heart of the gospel, here's the nub of it. It's not simply, here's the doctrine of Scripture, here's the doctrine of man. Westminster is a world view. Do you want to know why you should learn the Shorter Catechism? Because it's your world view. If you want to understand something about how to relate to people, go read the Larger Catechism on the Fifth Commandment. If you want to understand how to use your tongue, go read the Larger Catechism on the Ninth Commandment, on the Third Commandment. It's an expansive, enormous, public worldview. That's what Westminster is. Westminster was an attempt to bring the Reformation in to England and Ireland. Not surprisingly, the only church to ever adopt Westminster was the Church of Scotland. England and Ireland never took it. They didn't buy it. Westminster did not bring about the unity that it intended to bring. Its goal was to unify the British church. This is the essential truths of the Christian faith. Get that, by the way. You know how you think of Westminster? As like being the Reformed and Presbyterian document? When it was written, it was intended to be, this is the basis of unity in the Christian church. This is what every Christian should believe. It was actually considered a compromise and centrist doctrine, not right-wing or conservative or anything like that. With their confessions, with their covenants, they had this great, big, political, public view of the gospel. One last folkway. Here's their folkways. Here's how they live. They lived consumed with the gospel. They lived passing that zeal from one generation to the next. It was from top to bottom and bottom to top. It was a national thing. It was a big public and political vision. Last folkway, they failed. They failed. You'll hear that story throughout church history from any honest historian. They failed. Westminster did not unite the churches. Westminster did not bring peace to the land of Britain. Westminster did not have the buy-in of independents, Episcopalians, Anglicans, and eventually even the Presbyterians. Very few still held to it. The covenants did not bring Reformation. The covenants were outlawed when Charles II came back into power. You know how Charles II came back into power? The Covenanters put him there. The Scottish Covenanters put their persecutor back into power. It's a complicated story. And he outlawed the covenants. And he put Henderson and Gillespie and Rutherford under a death sentence. Anyone who signed the covenants were under a death sentence. They failed. But by no means. But by no means. What is a Scottish Covenanter? You've heard some of their stories. There's hundreds more I could have told. There are entire men whose stories you need to know that I just don't have time to tell you. Who are they? They are a people. They are a people who believe in the power of the gospel so much they'll die for it. They are a people who believe so much in the power of the gospel that they'll live for it. They are a people who believe so much in the power of the gospel that they will create the most ridiculous, absurd, and unattainable vision of the world and not stop until they have it. They will say, "My monarch must be godly." Well, what if he's not? There is no what if he's not. I believe in the power of the gospel. He must be godly. So we have these debates today. We have these discussions today. What are the Folkways of the Scottish Covenanters? What are my fathers like? And we ask these political questions. Should we participate in the political process? Should we vote? Should we give our assent to this or to that? Should we take vows to this or to that? And I want to take one thing off the table right now. Scottish Covenanters are not pragmatic. They are not practical. They don't wonder, will this work? They are convinced the gospel works. So they preach it. They live it. They love it. They die for it. And they don't care about the consequences. The results are God's business, not theirs. Gospel zeal passing from one person to the next. That's their folkway. Gospel zeal passing from one generation to the next. That's their folkway. A public and political expression of the gospel. That's their folkway. A full-orbed worldview. The whole counsel of God. That's the gospel in their worldview. That's their folkway. And they fail. And they fail. And they fail. And that's their folkway. But ladies and gentlemen, we are sitting here this morning inheriting that folkway. You're doing it. Your decision to be here this week and the decisions you get to make for the rest of your life can make their story come alive. You can be a Scottish Covenanter when you live for the gospel, when you die for the gospel, when you say the gospel is this huge transformation of the world, which is totally absurd and totally the reality. These are the folkways of the Scottish Covenanters. In 1528, Patrick Hamilton dies at the stake in St. Andrews. The first drop of blood is shed for the Scottish Reformation, for the Scottish Covenanters. In 1688, the Dutch William of Orange is made King of England. This is a compromise brought about by the English Puritans to get the Roman Catholic covenanting, persecuting James II off the throne. That he's known as William and Mary. They come to power 1688. It's called the Glorious Revolution, the Bloodless Revolution, something of that effect. And when this revolution comes to bear, William comes in with a very Dutch mindset into Britain. And he goes, so what's the problem here? And the English go, well, they want to be Anglican and they want to be Presbyterian. They want to be Reformed and they want to be... And William goes, you in Scotland want to be Presbyterian? Go be Presbyterian. You in England, you want to be Anglican? Okay, go be Anglican. You guys want to be Puritans, Independents, Congregationalists? All right, go be Congregationalists. So everybody gets what they want. Except for the Covenanters, who didn't just want to be Presbyterian. They wanted everybody else to be Presbyterian. They didn't just want to be Reformed. They wanted everybody to be Reformed. So they didn't like this settlement. And in 1688, they chose not to go in to the settlement, to not accept the settlement, to not become part of the Church of Scotland. And that's what marks our next story that we'll look at in the next hour about the immigrant covenanters, sets the stage for the immigrant covenanters. All right, let's close in prayer. Our God and Father, we thank you. We thank you for stories that remind us of the work you have done, of the men that have gone before. We thank you, Father, for stories that show us your love, your grace. Father, let us from top to bottom be consumed with a love for your gospel. Father, let us be consumed with a love for your gospel that teaches us to live by the gospel. Give us a love for the gospel that teaches us to die for the gospel. Father, I thank you for our fathers and their vision of the gospel. And I thank you for the lessons, Father, that we would not be as sinful as they have been, but that we would be far more righteous than they have been. Father, give us a heart that looks not only to our fathers, but most importantly to Jesus Christ, that we would be found in Him and walk in Him. For this we pray in His name. Amen.